To remember me and Dorothea and my grandfather Jimmy and my parents and all the rest of our family who came before them. Non-monogrammed gift ideas, if you must. I always love to give hostesses those little cheese knives and butter knives, the little ones that are specifically for hors d'oeuvres. Who doesn't need those? Yet I feel like nobody ever thinks to buy them for themselves. For young women, I vote pearls. They say diamonds are a girl's best friend, but my grandmother Dorothea always said that pearls are a Southern girl's best friend. A string of pearls is symbolic, a token typically given to mark a rite of passage, confirmation, 16th birthday, graduation, or engagement. At church on Sunday, you can glance from pew to pew, and all around you'll see women wearing their best pearls. One tradition in my family was to give add-a-pearl necklaces, whether tiny natural seed pearls on a delicate chain or starter strands of cultured pearls. Those were special occasion gifts it seemed like every girl I knew growing up got. I got mine for my confirmation. Pearls are a particularly great gift for a niece or a goddaughter. For my wedding, a dear friend gave me a pair of engraved brass horseshoes with my wedding date on them that I thought were so clever and that I treasure. When I need to give a wedding present, I'm not usually that creative. In fact, I always give the same thing. A cake plate. Always, always. Because you know what? Cake plates remind you of fun times and good things. No one is depressed when they see a cake plate. A cake is happiness with frosting on top. Chapter 6, Bluegrass Forever. Being from Nashville, I grew up surrounded by music. The entertainment at our school functions wouldn't be some random garage band, but rather famous country singers such as Brooks and Dunn, Amy Grant, or Emmylou Harris. It was normal for me to be around a lot of country music singers. The country music scene was like our Hollywood. I had so many favorites. Dolly Parton, of course. Alabama. The Oak Ridge Boys were huge when I was little. Roseanne Cash. Loretta Lynn. Barbara Mandrell was a major star because she and her sisters had a variety show on television. Every Saturday night, we were glued to it. Louise was the funniest Mandrell. She was my favorite. And not just because once at a music awards show, she took the stage in hot rollers. One of the great disappointments of my life was when I didn't get to play Barbara Mandrell in the fourth grade play. I was gutted. Fortunately, I got to play Mother Maybelle Carter instead, complete with auto harp. So I got an early country music history lesson on the Carter family. Maybe that's why I scored the part of June Carter Cash in Walk the Line, my intimate knowledge of all the Carter family's greatest hits. I knew the lyrics to Wildwood Flower before I ever shot one frame of the movie. My childhood was full of music, and I'm doing the same for my children. There's always music playing, and we're always singing songs to one another. My little boy is named Tennessee, so we sing him the University of Tennessee cheer. T-E-N-N-E-S-S-E-E, Tennessee. That's how he learned to spell his name. We also sing the University of Tennessee's unofficial fight song, the Osborne Brothers' 1967 country hit, Rocky Top, to him. He thinks it's hysterical. You know how much I like the song Rocky Top? I played it at my wedding, never mind that it has a line about corn from a jar. It reminds me of where I'm from. To me, bluegrass music is so soothing and comforting. I find it relaxing and just so happy, and I'll keep it on in the background as I go about my day. It's got its roots in Appalachia, and it makes me feel like I'm home. I love what Steve Martin said. The banjo is such a happy instrument. You can't play a sad song on the banjo. It always comes out so cheerful. Honky-tonkers don't cry. My mom, a retired nurse, works these days as a hostess at a honky-tonk. Your mom still works after she retired, someone asked me recently. I burst out laughing. She doesn't have to. She loves to. I beg her to relax, but she insists on working. I'm an extrovert, she says. You can't keep me at home. The best way to describe my mother is sunshine in human form. Smiling, laughing, always dancing, while practicing the deepest gratitude for life. deeply social, and a true optimist. She managed to end every day I was little with something nice to say about her job and telling me and my brother she loved us. She would sit on our beds and listen to our dreams, frustrations, and heartbreaks and say, "Everything's going to work out. You'll see." I remember crying one night when I was 14 years old because I wasn't even filling out my training bra. My mom soothed me by saying that my boobs would grow. In fact, one day, they'll be so big, you'll have to cart them around in wheelbarrows. Did I mention she's funny? We would watch Saturday Night Live together and laugh at the church lady and the cheerleaders. Betty's laugh was always the loudest, just so full and easy. She's not afraid of a good knee slap either. And boy, does my mother love to dance and sing. There's not a day of my childhood when I don't remember her dancing and singing. A born artist, she never met a blooming flower, dog, horse, landscape, or new city that she didn't marvel at. She finds beauty in simple things. Flowers on her front porch, a squirrel in the yard, a visit with her elderly neighbor. One time when I was 11 years old, she heard me and my friend gossiping about a boy at school, and she told us we should never speak ugly about people who weren't present. I never forgot those words, and I've taught my children that we should always find the best in people, like Grandma Betty does. She found purpose in her work as a nurse and a teacher, and she told me long stories about her students who were trying to become part of the medical workforce in Nashville. She had endless patience to listen to her students and answer their questions, and she took their struggles to heart. She felt pride in her work because she knew those men and women would be serving our community. To this day, I have people who come and tell me that my mother was their teacher, and it fills me with pride. It always made my day when she came home and told me she had spoken about me in her early childhood pediatrics class. I remember thinking she carried me with her, even when she was working. That meant the world to me and showed me the value of being a working woman. She taught me that it was important to tell children how fulfilling work can be so that they will want to find that sense of purpose in their own lives. I credit my mother for my work ethic. I am always happiest when I'm working because I learned from her that if you love your job and take pride in it, it really doesn't feel like working at all. That certainly is how she feels now about working at a honky-tonk. For those of you who don't know what a honky-tonk is, it's a great Southern nightclub with live music and dancing. Fun dancing, too, the kind anyone can do. When I was a kid, I took clogging lessons and learned cotillion dancing, and they were both work. But at a honky-tonk, there's no pressure. People of all ages just get up and start dancing, beer in hand. The spirit of the place is such that everybody will dance with anybody. No judgment if you're not a great dancer or need help learning the steps. It's all just in the spirit of fun. Of course, there's always a show-off or two to keep things lively. That guy who knows every dance, twirls every girl. To me, there's nothing more charming or appealing than a guy who knows how to dance like that. A king of Texas swing? Forget it. He's the only guy you want to dance with. My dear friend Howell, whom I've mentioned as my go-to dinner party guest, grew up in Texas, and he's been dancing like that forever. Naturally, if there will be any dancing at all, I insist that he come to the party with me. And invariably, he's the most popular man in the room. Maybe Howell's mom should be writing this book instead of me. She knows how to raise a good Southerner. Full Moon Midnight Barbecue Barn Party. My parents instilled a love of music in me early on. We would go listen to live music two or three nights a week, whether it was a bluegrass concert at the park or an evening at the Bluebird Cafe, where local songwriters test out their newest tunes. Sometimes, when there was a full moon during harvest time, we'd go to a midnight barn party at our friend's big backyard barn. That was my favorite outing. You'd show up in the backyard while it was still light out, and you'd see a barbecue going, and tons of hay bales set up in a big semicircle around the entrance to the barn. You'd hear crickets chirping, and you'd have to wear cowboy boots because this was a barn, after all, and you never knew what you might step in. As it got dark, the musicians would appear in the doorway of the barn and start playing bluegrass music. All different kinds of local musicians would join in. It would always start out with one act, then turn into a giant jam band by the end. And we kids were thrilled that we got to stay up till midnight. You had people from the whole community talking and laughing, and the children dancing up a storm on the grass. I think those nights are where my love of music, and especially live music, began. Bluegrass has been carried down as a tradition from generation to generation, and I love to see it continue. I have a cousin who makes all those old-fashioned instruments, such as mandolins and zithers, and I consider it a great tribute to our heritage. Now, as you might imagine, everyone worked up quite an appetite dancing. As happens so often in the South, at those midnight barn parties, music and food would go hand in hand. On the buffet table, there was always barbecue. You'd have hamburger buns and different kinds of sauces for different tastes, and then corn on the cob and lots of booze. These days, the spirit of those barn concerts lives on in some of the parties I go to around Nashville. For example, after the Country Music Awards, Ronnie Dunn and his wife Janine used to host a long-standing party where all the musicians would go back to his house and sing around a piano. It was magical. You'd see George Strait, members of Rascal Flatts, Martina McBride, Keith Urban, just singing away together. The country music community is so inclusive. Its members really care about one another, and there's no divisiveness. There's just this incredible spirit of collaboration in that we're all artists, and we all support one another. Those moments of togetherness around a Nashville piano are something we can all learn from. Southern Party Playlist. When I was appearing as June Carter in the film Walk the Line, I learned so much about the history of American music, how the Carter family traced the origins of country to old English folk songs and made sure to record every song for posterity. It made me appreciate the music all the more. Also, my party playlist got a million times better. These days, I usually just put Patsy Cline into Spotify and let the magic unfold. But if you want to curate your own Southern playlist, here are a few songs to get things off to a solid start. Patsy Cline's Walking After Midnight. Charlie Pride, Kiss an Angel Good Morning. George Strait, Troubadour. Hank Williams Jr., Family Tradition. Little Big Town, Boondocks. There are plenty more songs and the recipe for my brother John's ribs in the PDF. Chapter 7, The Family Table. These days, I feel as though I can barely sit still for 10 minutes without getting antsy. A lot of friends my age have the same issue. We're always looking at our watches halfway through a play or staring impatiently at the clock when we're waiting in line at the bank. What's going on with us? I used to be able to wait or to make it through a whole movie without wanting to check my phone or run around the block. For a while, I thought I was just getting older and battier, but now I think it's due to some combination of our faster pace of life, the onslaught of technology, and the feeling that there's so much to do that there's no time to waste. Family dinner is my only salvation from this affliction. We put all the devices away. I put some hot food on the table, and we say grace. It's really important to me for us to appreciate that we have very blessed lives and should be grateful every second of the day for all of our blessings. Grace is a time to raise the kids' awareness that we must take care of others who are not as fortunate and to remind them to think of the big picture. For as long as we're at the table, the rest of the world melts away. My kids love it when I make simple one-pot meals such as chili or crock-pot pot roast, or noodles with ground turkey and vegetables. Sometimes I'll go all out and do fried chicken and sides. After saying grace, as we eat, we'll each talk about our day's highlights. It's our little 5-year-old Tennessee's favorite thing to do. Some people I know call this dinner game Roses and Thorns. You have to say the best thing, the rose of your day, and the worst thing, the thorn. It's a good way to get out of the, how was school? Fine, rut. Also, over dinner, we might play a guessing game where one of us thinks of an animal, and the others have to ask questions about where it lives. It's a really good game with little kids, and they get excited because it feels very grown up and sophisticated to be playing a game with people of all ages. Each person can ask only one question about the animal to try and figure it out. My middle child thinks of things that are so hard that nobody can guess them. But it's really sweet to see the 5-year-old trying to figure it out. So serious. Is it an elephant? Is it a kitten? Deacon. Close. It's a North American marmot. When Jim and the kids and I are sitting there eating and laughing, I often flash back to family meals with my grandparents, which we'd often eat out on the screened-in porch, complete with soundtrack of the screen door's spring stretching, followed by the whapping sound the door made as it slammed. Adults would sip drinks on the porch before dinner and watch the sun go down as the kids played outside, filling jars with fireflies. I like to think my kids will look back on our dinners this way, how we talked and laughed together over plates of good, filling food, but even more fulfilling conversation. My grandparents loved our stories, hanging on every word and detail. We felt appreciated and important, as though our opinions mattered. My mother laughed loudest at all my jokes, so I always blame her for making me become an actor. She egged me on, which made me feel even bolder. Her laugh gave me courage. She has the best laugh in the world. Southern conversation starters. Now, heaven forbid anyone spills salt during a family dinner. You have to throw it over your left shoulder immediately. Or, well, you know, most of us growing up in the South never quite knew what would happen if we didn't abide by the superstition, but we knew it was bad. Here are a few of the more common superstitions we were raised with. I suppose adherence to such arbitrary rules might make us seem a little unhinged sometimes, but when you're constantly on the lookout for omens of ill fortune, it does keep the day lively. A hat on a bed is bad luck. If you sweep a broom under a young woman's feet, she'll never marry. Never stir any liquid with a knife. It leads to strife. Walking under a ladder is bad luck. If a black cat crosses your path, you'll have bad luck unless you go home and start your trip again. A broken mirror means 7 years bad luck. Don't put your purse on the floor. If you do, it's money out the door. If you want to see my cornbread chili pie recipe, check out the PDF. Chapter 8, Dolly Parton, Southern Icon. No discussion of the South is complete without a tribute to that eternal symbol of Southern womanhood, Dolly Parton. Here's my Dolly story. I have a vivid memory of being 6 years old and skipping rope on the blacktop in my first grade PE class. My teacher, Mrs. Wright, who is still a teacher at my old school, asked me, "Reese, what do you want to be when you grow up?" As I've mentioned, by that point, I had considered becoming the first female president of the United States, and Mrs. Willie Nelson. But now, at the ripe age of 6, I had a new, loftier ambition. Without missing a skip, I said, "Mrs. Wright, when I grow up, I'm going to be Dolly Parton." I was, in fact, convinced that I was going to be her, or at least a funny, smart, blonde country music singer in her image. I could see it so clearly. I would have a variety show just like Dolly Parton. I would have her glittery wardrobe, and above all else, I would have that voice. Well, it wasn't meant to be. I took singing lessons to no avail. It's one of the great tragedies of my life that I was born without the talent to become a country music singer. In retrospect, it's pretty funny how bad I was at singing, and how long it took for me to take the hint. When I was 13 years old, I began entering Nashville acting and singing competitions. I'd always win the acting ones, but I would never even place in the singing ones. Still, I continued to sing out. If nothing else, at that stage, competing taught me that I always had a song in my heart, and that I really enjoyed performing, no matter what sort of feedback I was getting on the vocal part. Then I got an opportunity to go to a camp in the Catskills of upstate New York with hundreds of kids who all had dreams of being on Broadway. I was soon told the following: "You, in the front, yeah, you, please stop singing. Acting's your thing, focus on that." Finally, I accepted reality. In the long run, that experience taught me that learning what I wasn't good at was just as important as learning what I was. That is a huge life lesson. And that brings us back to Dolly. because it was there, in the Catskills, at age 13, that I had to surrender my dream of being her. But sometimes dreams have a strange way of coming true, even after you abandon them. At 14, I started acting professionally, and then, many years later, I got one of the most important roles of my career, Walk the Line. That meant I had to do a lot of research about June Carter and the Carter family. Well, my father was a surgeon in Nashville who worked on people's vocal cords. He never told me who his patients were, because he was a professional. But when some of his patients heard that I would be playing Johnny Cash's wife, they offered to send me videotapes and pictures and memorabilia. One of those generous people was Dolly. That's right. Dolly Parton. The Dolly Parton reached out and offered to meet me and help me to prepare for my role. She said she'd help me with any guidance she could about context for the Carter family. Well, I was over the moon, and we set a date. She picked me up in her car. One of her cousins was driving us, and we went to a 3-hour dinner. She told me stories from her life in country music and so many things she knew about the Carter family, and especially Johnny Cash. She was incredibly generous with her time and her experiences, which really helped inform my performance. More even than the great insights she had, she gave me courage. Leaving that dinner, I felt emboldened to play the role, even though I still feared I wouldn't be credible as a country music singer. In fact, when the film's director, Jim Mangold, had hired me, my response had been, "Great, you're going to get Leanne Rimes to sing for me, right?" I had, after all, been hearing for about 20 years people saying, "Please don't sing." But Jim felt confident I could sing on screen, and Dolly told me I could do it. So I had to have faith. I took singing lessons for 7 months to prepare. Our producer, T-Bone Burnett, coached me too. He taught me that singing isn't about perfection. It's about emotion. He guided my performance so that even if mine wasn't the most proficient voice possible, it always came from my heart. Still, I confess, I thought I was going to throw up every single time I shot a scene where I sang. Have you seen the movie? There's a lot of singing, y'all. But I just drank a beer, and I did it anyway. And it worked out okay. A lot of key moments in life are like that. You can be nervous as all get out. Just drink a beer and do it anyway. June Carter Cash ended up being a very important role in my career. And I've always been really appreciative of everyone who contributed in any way to that film, especially Dolly Parton, for helping me get there. Dolly and I have stayed in touch since, and she's remained a very caring and supportive figure in my life. When I started Draper James, she was one of the first people to say, "Hey, how can I help you?" She even came down and shopped. And when I called her and asked, "Can I create a product that says, 'What would Dolly do?' Because I think it all the time," she said, "Absolutely." She continues to inspire me to no end. Here is a woman who came from profoundly humble beginnings, yet she has thrived and continues to be so deeply grateful to and appreciative of every person who has helped her, including every single fan. I love her positivity and her cultural outreach in the South. Did you know that as part of her far-reaching literacy program, Imagination Library, she sends free books to children ages birth to five in communities all around the country and in the UK, Canada, and Australia. "Who knows," she said of her work, "maybe there's a little girl whose dream it is to be a writer and singer. The seeds of these dreams are often found in books, and the seeds you help plant in your community can grow across the world." Beyond being a fabulous entertainer, she's a wonderful person. So for me, she's the ultimate Southern icon. Honorary Southern icon, Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Cambridge. Why do Southern women like British royalty? I have a girlfriend whose entire Instagram account is made up of photos of the royal family. As a little girl, I used to watch everything that came on television about Princess Diana. My mother follows the rise and fall of the royals' fortunes closely. Why? I asked her this the other day, and we decided that Southern women like how the royals value family and how they're always doing good for others. there's also their keen attention to propriety and sense of tradition. Plus, of course, the dresses. Southern women love pomp and circumstance. Still, I felt relatively immune from the obsession with the royals until a few years ago when I was invited to meet Kate Middleton. She had just married Prince William, and she was coming to Los Angeles for a fundraiser. I don't even know how I got so lucky as to receive the invitation. The scream that issued from my lips upon receiving it? You would have thought I was going to die. I wake up early, mind you, but on that day, I was up at 4 a.m. doing my hair. That's early, even for me.
"I've never seen you this excited," my husband said.
He wasn't kidding. I was up, dressed, and waiting by the door by 7 a.m. Jim took pictures of me in the car. You can see rays of happiness shooting out of my face. I love Kate Middleton that much. And she did not disappoint. She was just lovely and warm, elegant and composed. She also told a joke. I immediately fell under her spell. She's just as magnificent as she seems to be. She's a very compassionate, socially conscious, deeply caring person. What's more, it takes a very special person to decide to commit to that kind of life, to choose to be under public scrutiny every moment. Now that she's in that position, her entire life is in service, forever. I'm so in awe of that kind of dedication. Chapter 9, My Grandfather's Garden. I know I've talked in this book an awful lot about my grandmother, Dorothea. I do associate flowers and beautiful scents with her. She had about a dozen bottles of floral perfumes, some with cut crystal stoppers. Her favorite scent was Joy. As a little girl, I loved to sneak in her room and dab a bit behind my ears. Yet her husband, James Witherspoon, my grandfather Jimmy, is who I think of when I think of Southern flowers. He was one of the greatest influences in my life. I worshipped him. I followed him everywhere as a child and would drop anything to play checkers with him on the porch. The tallest person in our family, a whopping 6'1", we are a family of shorties. He was a World War II veteran. He served as a fighter pilot and a high school principal. He'd grown up on a farm in Midlothian, Texas, and he kept farmer's hours, waking up each morning at dawn. My grandfather was never happier than when he was working around his magnolia trees, hydrangeas, peonies, and irises, which are both the Tennessee state flower, and my mother's favorites. When I stayed with my grandparents from the age of 3, I'd wake up early too, so I could have the honor of helping my grandfather in the garden. We would eat Cheerios and bananas before heading out to work, mowing the lawn or painting the house. He always worked in white coveralls, coming in only for a sandwich at midday, and then again around 5 o'clock to shower and change for dinner. Being his helper was my very first job. As I followed him everywhere, I asked a million questions about the garden, the gutters, the lawnmower, the cars. You name it. If he was working on something, I had a question, and he always had a patient answer for me. His flower garden was his pride and joy, and he did every bit of the work on it himself. In the huge expanse of my grandparents' backyard, my grandfather nurtured, planted, and maintained a prolific garden. He dug up the entire backyard each spring, the tired beds full of dried-out, gone-to-seed plants left from the end of the previous growing season, and would spend hour upon hour turning the soil and planning out every single thing he wished to grow for the season ahead. From the nursery catalogs that filled my grandparents' mailbox, he would select the seeds to plant: tomatoes, okra, green beans, and lots of flowers, too. He grew masses of zinnias for the rabbits to eat, so they'd leave his vegetables alone. Each day, he would walk his garden and water and check on his plants, wandering from row to row. To this day, one of my most vivid memories is being in the garden with him, probably around the age of 5, following behind him with my endless chatter. He stopped and said, "Race, less talking, more working on the plants." I learned to stop and appreciate the plants. Because I was paying so much attention that summer, I noticed exactly when the tomatoes turned red,
and it was a thrilling day for me. At harvest time, I walked the rows with him, picking mountains of beans, and then I'd sit on the back porch with my grandma, snapping and stringing them for hours. In the mornings, Jimmy and I would deliver fresh tomatoes to neighbors' doorsteps. Jimmy showed me firsthand what a life of hard work and service looks like. His garden reflected his nurturing spirit. For the rest of my life, the scent of fresh tomatoes will bring my mind racing back to those times. Today, at my house in California, I plant roses and vegetables in a small garden. It brings me such joy, especially in the early summer when I see the first signs of growth. My kids aren't much for gardening so far, but one day, I think they'll remember that I love flowers, the same way I remember so clearly how my grandfather Jimmy did. Honeysuckle. Honeysuckle grows like wildfire in the South. It covers the hedges, creek sides, and garden walls. It grows wherever there's water and heat, so basically the entire South, from May to October. That sweet floral fragrance reminds me of my youth. We had a big honeysuckle bush in our side yard that would blossom every spring. My brother taught me to pinch off the blossom and pull the stem out to suck out the nectar. The neighborhood kids and I could spend hours doing that. As if they weren't pretty enough on their own, they often attract hummingbirds and butterflies too. Chapter 10, Making Special Occasions Special. Special occasion entertaining is some of the best entertaining there is, because you have an event around which all the activities arrange themselves. In this chapter, I'll talk about the usual special events, like weddings and baby showers, but I'll also mention a few Southern-specific ones, like the Kentucky Derby, steeplechase, and the Nashville Symphony Ball. What they all have in common is a sense of community, and of course, great food. Weddings. I happen to love a church wedding, because I'm a practicing Episcopalian. Not to be confused with a pescatarian. My daughter Ava went through a period for 2 or 3 years where she didn't eat meat, only fish, a pescatarian diet. At that time, my son Deacon was in kindergarten, and they were talking about vegetarians. "Does anyone know anyone who has a different diet?" the teacher asked. Deacon raised his hand and said, "I do. My sister is Episcopalian. She eats only fish." Growing up, I loved church. I was in the choir for 9 years. I loved going every Wednesday after school and every Saturday to practice. I loved singing loud up there at the front every Sunday. We were told that if you weren't singing loudly, God couldn't hear you. Choir was great practice for being in theater. I learned how to project to the back pews, and you have to be on time and church ready by the first church service. All those little old ladies are waiting. I had such a positive, accepting religious upbringing. Our church was traditional, but progressive at the same time. The parish and ministry were both diverse. We learned that Christianity is about making people feel welcome and reserving judgment of them. The church for me has always been a safe place to learn about doing work for others, being respectful, and being part of a community. In Nashville, you go to church on a Sunday, and then you'd see the same folks on Monday at work or school or the grocery store. Small town living has its upsides. So naturally, I love a church wedding. But I also think it's nice if festivities take place outside. It's so great to enjoy the beauty of being in nature at this important moment in your life. Letting nature set the mood. Even a little rain can be so beautiful. And I like the superstition that it's good luck. At Southern weddings, there are always a lot of bridesmaids. Let me tell you why I think that is. People are so darn polite in the South, and they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But it's also because you want the maximum number of people standing around you, helping you make this huge commitment. The people you invite to your wedding are the people who are supposed to guard your vows of marriage and help you enjoy the good times and make it through the bad times. You know, there are ups and downs in every marriage. No one can escape that. And beware of anyone who goes on and on about their perfect marriage. It's usually not the full truth. The friends you invite to your wedding are supposed to be there for you both, so you need to be very thoughtful about how you pick them. A piece of advice: do not let anyone pressure you into having random people at your wedding. It's such an intensely personal and private moment, you know? And those are the people you're going to be telling your hopes and dreams to. It's not about getting another blender or letting some great aunt show you off. It's about real vulnerability. And you are the ones who get to choose who gets to see that vulnerability. And most importantly, it's a party. When it comes to the food, I always love it when there's both a groom's cake and a bride's cake. Usually the bride's is a traditional white cake and the groom's is a chocolate cake. Both are important because variety is the spice of life. And of course, the most important thing at any wedding is the music. People must dance early and often and with the maximum number of people on the dance floor. At my wedding, my husband's friends very sweetly danced with all the older ladies. My mom had the time of her life, and so did my husband's mom. Always find a cute game friend who will make it his job to keep all the old ladies happy by dancing with them. You get a lot of points in my book for being the guy who dances with the grannies. I've seen a trend toward kid-free weddings, and I have to say, it's not ideal in my book. I think going to weddings is an important way to show children what marriage means, what community means, and what commitment is all about. If they don't get to see the ritual enacted, how are they going to learn? Children need to understand that people stand up for each other, that they care for each other, that they care for their families, and that when they're in love, they want to bring their families together in celebration. I also feel that having kids around keeps us mindful of what a wedding is about. It's a family occasion, not a fashion show. And now let's get real. I've had two weddings. The first time I got married, it was at a gorgeous old farm property in Charleston with giant moss-covered oak trees. Charleston is one of the most magical places in our country. It's no wonder so many people get married there. The second time, I got married at my own house, which was a beautiful working farm with chickens, dogs, and goats running around. Yes, I had a farm for a while, before I realized how hard it is to have a farm. I sold it to people who wanted to be full-time farmers. I miss the chickens, but it's better for everyone this way. So there I was in one of the rooms of my farmhouse getting dressed, and my best friend since college, Heather, grabbed my hands. I braced for a pep talk. "Are you ready?" she asked. "Yes," I said, taking a deep breath. "Are you excited?" she said. "Yes," I said and smiled. "Good," she said, "because you only get married for the second time. Once." I burst out laughing, but my eyes teared up too, because it was true. Life isn't about perfection. There is no rule book. Life has many different chapters, and every chapter deserves celebrating. That point was driven home again moments later, when I went to stand up and leave the room to head to the ceremony. I'd been sitting on a bed in my dress for some time, with my bridesmaids and flower girls and other close family members around me. We were all talking away. Then when the time came, I began to stand up and found I was rooted to the bed by my veil. I looked back and saw several little children sitting on my veil, eating crackers. Crumbs everywhere. Heather and I cracked up. Let's face it, folks. Life is not a perfect tableau. So just brush off the crumbs and get the show on the road. And you know what? That wedding day was one of the most beautiful, joyful days of my life. But of all the glorious moments, from my future husband Jim standing there with our pastor waiting for me, to the sight of so many people I love dancing together for pure joy, it's hard to beat the memory of Heather making me laugh out loud, or that image of those precious little boys and girls sitting on my veil, happily snacking away in a field of white tulle. Baby showers. Baby showers are just so fun, especially, I think, for those of us who have been mothers for a while. We get to share stories from the trenches, and we get to marvel at how impossibly small and precious baby socks are. Heather made a homemade cake for my last baby shower, and it was gorgeous. 3 layers of white cake, layered with whipped cream, with fresh flowers on the top.
Not everyone loves shower games, but I can't get enough of them. I especially like games that involve all the generations. I'm partial to guessing people's pregnancy cravings, and I love a big gender reveal. Like when you cut the cake and the icing inside is either pink or blue. Whoever invented that is a genius. One of the things we did for a girlfriend of mine was that each of us had to bring a piece of fabric for the baby that meant something to us. We told the story of what it meant, and then all the pieces of the fabric were sewn into a quilt for the baby. Now her daughter has this gorgeous keepsake filled with love forever. How special. Pre-gaming a gala. This menu is straight from my mom. My parents went to a lot of cultural events in Nashville, especially for the Nashville Symphony. And when they did, they would have friends over first for drinks. It was a win-win for me. They'd serve tasty hors d'oeuvres, and I'd get to admire the ladies' dresses. I always longed to go out with them, but I was too young, so my brother John and I would stay home playing Boggle and eating all the leftover snacks. Now I get dressed up and go to fancy parties too, but I always make sure we have these snacks before we go. If you want a good pregame menu, see the PDF for Confetti Betty's Champagne and Ginger Ale Cocktail, Smoked Pecans, and Crab Puffs. Kentucky Derby. Dad used to drive us to Louisville, Kentucky to see the Kentucky Derby when we were kids. It was so close to Nashville, just a 3-hour drive. He would give us money to bet on one horse, so we were very invested for the 2 hours it took the race to begin. Now I have derby parties at my home, because who doesn't want to get dressed up, drink mint juleps, eat derby pie, and wear a fun giant hat? Kentucky Derby Party. The main thing at a derby party is the classic drink, a mint julep in a silver cup. This can be supplemented with some snacks like deviled eggs and hot brown bites. Don't forget a derby pie to eat once the race is over, so everyone can celebrate their betting victories. Or recover from their favorite horse's defeat. All my favorite derby recipes, from mint juleps to deviled eggs to hot brown bites to derby pie, can be found in the PDF. Cheekwood. A very fancy old-time fundraising ball is held every year at Cheekwood, a historic estate in Nashville, set on 55 acres that include a vast botanical garden. I've always loved Cheekwood, which was donated to the city by the Cheek family. They amassed a fortune from their grocery empire, including Maxwell House Coffee. Remember Good to the Last Drop? My grandmother and I often met for lunch or tea time in Cheekwood's Pineapple Room, which has long been the place in town for the Ladies Who Lunch set. Every time we went, we were guaranteed to see half a dozen ladies Dorothea knew. On holiday breaks as a teenager, I served as a docent at Cheekwood. From Thanksgiving to New Year's Day, the Trees of Christmas exhibit featured fir trees decked out by local businesses in different themes, such as visions of sugar plums or Christmas around the world. It was my job to guide people through the exhibit and explain why a decoration had been chosen by a tree's designer. I loved it because I got to pretend I was an art historian in a fancy museum. Did I mention I was a huge nerd? Transferware. Growing up, I found that nearly every Nashville dining room I walked into had steeplechase-themed wallpaper. My grandmother took the trend to heart. She had the wallpaper and the dishes. She loved a horse theme, particularly when it came to her antique English transferware. Transferware is a kind of ceramics made using transfer printing that dates to 18th century England and usually has a country scene in white and blue or white and red. Once you get into a pattern, you can get addicted to collecting it. Dorothea eventually owned every piece in her pattern set, from dinner plates and teacups to platters and bowls, plus a big soup tureen and ladle that my dad and I stumbled upon while rummaging around the flea market at the Fairgrounds, Nashville, early one Saturday morning. That piece became the focal point of her dining room, often spilling over with fresh peonies from her backyard garden. To this day, transferware is my favorite item to hunt for at a flea market. I always feel as though I've hit the lottery when I find a piece of cranberry-colored transferware that Dorothea would have loved, with a horse on it, of course.
Steeplechase. The Iroquois Steeplechase horse race has been a Nashville tradition for more than 75 years. It's a great excuse to put on a pretty dress and have some fun. Seersucker, linen, bow ties, pocket squares, embellished hats, and wacky fascinators. It's all fair game at Steeplechase. Every year, my parents and their friends would get together at someone's home for cocktails before taking a picnic of pulled pork sliders to the track. Are you curious about my Steeplechase picnic menu with pulled pork sliders and old-fashioned cocktails? Then go to the PDF. Chapter 11, Catching Frogs and Selling Lemonade. What I loved about being a child in the South was that we played outdoors all the time. Playing Atari games was a real treat, but most of our days were spent running around the neighborhood, riding our bikes, climbing trees, and getting covered in mud. I had one of those idyllic childhoods where I would get home at 3 o'clock, throw down my backpack, and run outside with my brother to join the neighborhood kids for kickball or tag until it got dark. Kids ran into one another's houses, shared one another's homes. There weren't a lot of rules, boundaries, or playdates. No one scheduled us. I learned about social dynamics by having to get along with whatever bunch of random kids happened to be outside on any given day. There was a creek that ran through our neighborhood. We would all walk down to the creek and catch crawdads or frogs. To this day, if I see a frog, I will chase it, to my husband's horror. How to catch a frog with your bare hands. Step 1. Be quiet. You have to sneak up on a frog. Step 2. Cheaters use nets. You want to use your hands. Grab the frog, fast, by the legs with one hand. Support the rest of the frog with your other hand. Step 3. Carry it around for a minute or two and show it off. Startle your parents, or if you're me, your husband. Step 4. Release back into the pond. In the evening, whenever our folks left the house, my brother and I would go on a mission to eat all the sweets we could find. John was the family spy. He always managed to see where my mom hid the best treats. And the minute the adults departed, we would find the stash. He would drag the big kitchen stool next to the fridge and climb up to get mom's hidden stash of M&Ms or moon pies. Joy was staying up past our bedtime, watching cartoons, hiding the empty candy bags behind the sofa cushions. At the same time, we were expected to clean up nicely and to have impeccable manners in polite society. We were taught to look people in the eye and to say hello and smile. Smiling at people is a big part of life in the South. If a child does not wave back at someone walking down the street, don't be surprised if an adult says, "Excuse me, little one. Where are your manners?" Good manners take very little effort. It's not that hard to smile. My mother likes to say, smiles are contagious. Try smiling at people you don't even know for a day. Even if you're not in Nashville, most of them will smile back at you. It really does make a difference. Those little daily kindnesses, they can really change the mood of a block, a neighborhood, a city. My mother made sure we knew it was a necessity to be extra nice to people doing the hard jobs that make other people more comfortable, like waiters, salespeople, and hotel workers. I love the way my husband is with people at a restaurant. In fact, I always observe how people act with waiters. It says a lot. My kids sometimes meet hundreds of new people a week because we have to travel so much for my work. I think there's something really great about their learning to look people in the eye, to introduce themselves, to be respectful, to take care of other people's property. We always say in the South that good manners are a kind of passport. If you have good manners, you can go everywhere, and people are glad to have you around. In this spirit, I grew up saying please and thank you, and yes, ma'am, and no, sir. It actually took a long time to drum that ma'am habit out of me. I had to live in California for at least 15 years before I stopped calling women even 5 years older than me, ma'am. What can I say? It was a huge part of my upbringing. We were taught manners by example. The older women in our families were unflappably polite. Southern women are strong and outspoken, but also beautifully composed, and always present their best selves to the world. They believe in character and the presentation of that character. They aren't afraid to tell you how they really feel. Someone once told me they thought people in the South were passive-aggressive in their politeness. Certainly not. In my experience, a Southern woman will tell you right to your face if she doesn't like something. If my mother or grandmother wasn't pleased with my behavior, she'd say, "I don't like that. The way you're behaving is ugly. I don't like when children behave ugly." I feared their disapproval, and one pointed look from either one of them could terrify me. Getting a "stop acting ugly" was just the worst. I hated disappointing my grandma or my mother. But they also taught me to strive for behavior that was beautiful. And in my mother and grandmother's eyes, what was beautiful was treating others with respect and putting your best foot forward. Taking care of your community was beautiful, as was doing nice things for others. My grandma always said, "Pretty is as pretty does." People aren't pretty if they act ugly. One time, my grandma caught me chewing gum. She said, "The only appropriate place to chew gum is behind a door." One time, I really wanted to chew gum, so I went behind the door to do it, just to prove a point. But it made me realize that some people think it's rude to chew gum around them. I like gum, but I was able to see my grandmother's perspective. There's a time and a place for chewing gum, because let's just face it, it can be a little gross watching other people chew. Business lessons. One other thing the South gave me as a child was a good work ethic. I had two business ventures as a young person, and both taught me lessons that I still put into practice today. The first was a lemonade stand. I think a lemonade stand is a really good way for kids to learn about business. My brother and I took it very seriously. We would fill one of our mom's huge tea pitchers with ice-cold lemonade and set up our table with paper cups, napkins, and a mason jar to hold our money. John and I always fought about pricing. He's 4 years older and thought we should be charging more than I thought we should. We would compromise on a quarter a cup because we could take those quarters straight to the arcade afterward. Creating the sign for the lemonade stand was my favorite part. Give me markers and some poster board and I am in my element. I also liked innovating. I'd find ways for our stand to be special, such as putting mint leaves in the cup, or having both iced tea and lemonade so people could create their own Arnold Palmer. Being the loudmouth of the family, I was also the designated barker. I would flag down cars and harangue people into extra cups. "Doesn't your husband want a cup too?" My brother and I developed quite a reputation on our block for running a tidy business. Our second venture was our more innovative by far. It all began in third grade with some hair clips. I spotted them at the mall. They were very cool and just 50 cents a piece, and they were glimmering with potential. I had my brother front me some money as an investment so I could get a lot of them and some paint pens. I wrote my name with paint pen on the barrettes, wore them to school, and waited for other girls to notice. It didn't take long. Soon they started asking me if I'd make them barrettes. Sure, I would. For $2. They would meet me at my desk before or after school, and in bubble letters, I'd write their name or a chosen slogan in paint pen for a markup of $1.50. The orders poured in. It became like a status symbol. Everybody had to have a hair clip. And so began my first real triumph in the entrepreneurial space. I learned a lot of principles of business that way. I learned about pricing and that margins are important. I learned that the customer is always right. If she didn't like the writing, I had to redo it and absorb the cost of the one that she didn't like. I learned that marketing is everything. But I flew too close to the sun. I spent more time on my barrette business than on my schoolwork, became a distraction to the girls around me, and got paint pen all over my desk. As a result, I got into a lot of trouble, and my business was shut down by my third grade teacher. Ah, the hazards of an elementary school startup. In both the lemonade stand and barrette business, I loved learning about how business works. I was fascinated with the idea of turning a profit. I wasn't afraid of hard work, and I liked engaging the market. It made me understand supply and demand. Also, I did like making enough cash to maintain my very expensive sticker collection. People of my generation might remember this phenomenon. We had books with all kinds of stickers, from scratch and sniff ones to shiny backs to puffy ones, Garfield, Peanuts, all of it. But the hardest to get, most desirable ones by far, were Mystics. They had a sort of plasma inside. Some people called them oilies, and usually had cosmic dreamy themes such as unicorns or wizards. A penguin with a bow tie? Ooh. Butterflies, sharks, poodles, hot air balloons. They were a dollar each. A dollar! All I can say, it's good I was doing so well with my businesses because I needed those stickers. Bad. How 1980s business people got kids addicted to stickers, I will never understand. But it was pretty pervasive. The main thing I learned from all my entrepreneurial success was that working with my brother on the funding for the hair clip venture or on selling lemonade made those things more fun. To this day, it's important to me to really enjoy the people I work with. That's another thing I learned way back in elementary school. Don't go into business with people you don't like, because you never know whether or not you'll be successful in the end. So it's important to enjoy the journey. These days, I don't start a movie, a television show, or a business with people I'm not ready to spend a lot of time with. Because let's face it, if work is fun, it doesn't feel like work.